Karibuni sana to the Rift Valley Forum, and thank you once again for spending your afternoon with us and for joining us in this forum. This is part of our 8-country election series in partnership with Henrik Boll Foundation. The election series that we have will be covering broad themes, constitutions and electoral institutions, civic space and active citizen participation, women's political participation, media and security. These are themes that cut across all elections in the East and Horn of Africa. The countries that we are covering in this series are Tanzania, Uganda, South Sudan, Sudan, Somalia, Somaliland, Ethiopia, and Djibouti. This was going to be a forum on the upcoming Ethiopia elections, but I think we're all cognizant of the situation in Ethiopia, and so we slightly changed the focus of this discussion, but of course also aware of the root causes of this conflict. So earlier this year, the Ethiopian government announced the postponement of all parliamentary and regional elections, originally planned for August 2020, but of course to curb the spread of COVID-19, this was postponed. The move was later endorsed through a constitutional interpretation adopted by the House of Federation. However, opponents of the Prime Minister, particularly the Tigray People's Liberation Front, saw the delay as a strategy for the Prime Minister to extend his term beyond its original mandate. As a result, the Tigray region held its own parliamentary elections on 9 September 2020, a move that exacerbated an already tense political atmosphere in the country. In October, as we are aware, the political tensions escalated and a military conflict between Tigray and Ethiopian National Defense Forces started in November. Massive mobilization and heavy fighting across the region ensued, with thousands of Tigrays being displaced, including over 30,000 crossing the border into neighboring Sudan, and I think some in South Sudan. With telecommunications lines cut and the internet switched off, there's very limited space for civil society and humanitarian actors to operate in this region, and coverage of the conflict by media is patchy and obstructed. We hope that this forum and panel discussion will add to the insights and perspectives on the role that regional bodies and civil society can play in managing and mitigating the conflict, which threatens the lives of thousands of people in and around the Tigray region, plus the stability of Ethiopia and the Horn of Africa more broadly. Our moderator today is Mosab Baba. Mosab is the co-director and media development director of GISA Group, which is a media development and civic engagement organization based in Sudan. Our panelists today are Rashid Abdi, a research and political analyst with Sahan, Peter Kamalingin, of the Pan-African Program Director, representative to AU from Oxfam International, Kibreb Abera Lomencho, a lawyer and activist based in Ethiopia, and Rita Musachi, who is the Secretary of the Horn of Africa Civil Society. My name is Pauline Otieno-Skepa, and I'm the forum manager here at the Rift Valley Institute. The Rift Valley Forum is a neutral platform that is dedicated to critical exploration and discussion and debate on important political, economic, and social issues within the Horn and Eastern Africa. Being very aware of the situation in Ethiopia and the tensions therein, we ask that we all present ourselves in a democratic and respective manner. There is no either or in the discussion in this space. We're just here to interrogate and try and find analysis and some kind of way forward. So interrogating the obvious gray space that is wide between these two polarizing sides. So thank you, panelists. I think we will start really by setting the context of this conflict and the context of the spaces that the civil society original bodies can navigate. And I'd like to start with you, Rashid, to give us that contextual foundation for the discussion. And also just give us, a regional overview of what is happening, a regional perspective of what is happening. Of course, again, very aware that we say we're trying to navigate or stay away from the politics of this conflict, but we know that it is very much steeped in politics. But Rashid?
Thank you very much, Pauline. I think the situation in Ethiopia is very fluid, continues to change day by day. We have seen 4 weeks of very intense fighting between the TPLF and the Ethiopian federal government, supported by a coalition of ethnic forces drawn from the federal states. Now, the government claims to be in total control of Tigray, and a few days ago captured the city Mekele. However, the TPLF continues to dispute that is the case. The government has imposed a complete total media and communication blackout all across Tigray. So it is actually very difficult to get verifiable information, but also to deploy independent observers or media to basically find out what is happening. So I must stress that the picture remains in Ethiopia extremely murky and very difficult to verify. However, what we know is that there are skirmishes continuing in many parts of Tigray, and we are beginning to see all the hallmarks of an insurgency which is taking root. I think the TPLF probably left Mekele before the ENDF took over with the bulk of their weaponry, but also with their leadership intact. So as we predicted, I think a number of times, this war is not going to be over anytime soon. It's going to be with us for a long time. Of course, no one doubts the firepower of the ENDF, but the terrain and the geography and the history of Tigray clearly suggests that this is going to be a long drawn out insurgency in Tigray. But I think coming back to the point of this discussion this afternoon, which is what role civil society plays in peace and conflict, I think is quite important. In many ways, the reason why the two belligerents, I think, went to war was partly an indictment of the civil society in Ethiopia. For a variety of reasons and history, I think the civil society in Ethiopia is extremely weak, has been emasculated throughout the decades by very strong and authoritarian states, which have plagued that country for a long time. So it isn't any surprise that you don't have a very strong, very robust civil society. The other problem, I think, is that you also have a civil society that is deeply fragmented along ethnic lines. And this is, I think, not unfamiliar, because it is the same case, I think, in many parts of Africa. But I think in Ethiopia, the ethnic fissures and the ethnic animosities are very deep and have actually been growing to a frightening level. Just to give you an example, the Orthodox Church historically has been very powerful and very strong, has been involved in peacemaking and conflict resolution. But the Coptic Church is now deeply split along ethnic lines. For example, the Coptic Church in Amhara State is very much stridently pro-war, whereas the Orthodox Church in Tigray, as well as Eritrea, are all in favor of peace. And that is a clear indication of actually the deep split within the civil society. But I think going forward, there is also a bigger role for civil society to play in the coming few weeks, largely, I think, because the humanitarian situation is very bleak in Tigray. So I think there will be need for the civil society to at least mobilize and lean on the government and the TPLF to first of all allow a humanitarian corridor, a civilian safe haven, but also to push the belligerents to actually respect the humanitarian law and laws governing conflict. So I think this is going to be a very critical role. The voice of the split, deeply polarized, and you need a neutral voice. And I think for the time being, that neutral voice hasn't emerged. But I think as the horrors of war become visible in the coming days and weeks, the mounting civilian casualties, the difficulties of this conflict, I think we will begin to see the emergence of a civil society in Ethiopia. But also critically, I think this conflict is not going to be resolved by war. Ultimately, the two parties will have to come together around a table and agree some sort of a political settlement. And I think that is where also the civil society will need to play a very critical role. So that is, I think, my opening statement for the time being. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Rashid. And I think that's a good segue to bring you in, Peter, of course, as the Pan-Africa Director for Oxfam. As we talk about, and Rashid has sort of laid down the groundwork very well for the civil society in Ethiopia. Looking at the regional bodies, of course, when I talk about regional bodies, the first one that comes to mind is the AU and, of course, IGAD. And sort of trying to look at what their role is at this moment in time, when Ethiopia seems to be falling apart. Ethiopia is where the AU is seated. What is their space? What can they do?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much, Pauline. And thanks, Rashid, as well. I think for a very good way you have laid that out. I'm happy, and thanks to the Rivalry Institute as well, and for everyone for making time to discuss this important issue about an important country in our region. I think maybe before I come to what you asked me on the agency of the Union, I think I just wanted to share my own anecdote. I think I was in Ethiopia at the beginning of 2018, or thereabout in the middle of 2018, after the change into the current government. And I traveled throughout all the region. And I think I want to say that I have never seen a more hopeful, more happier country than that at that moment. It was a lot of hope. It was a very hopeful country at that time. And to be fair, I think there have been some momentum out of that, that all of us thought that probably this critical country in the Horn was on its way to real transformation, which was hopefully going to also positively affect the wider Horn and the continent. Because as we all know, Ethiopia has a special place in Africa. It's the epicenter of Pan-African spirit. It reinforces that African identity and resistance to colonialism. And if you speak to many of the people who say they are Pan-Africanists, they say it's the mecca of Pan-Africanism itself because it birthed the OAU and it is also the location of the AU headquarters. So that is an important country. And what happens in Addis Ababa or in Abyssinia is important for the entire continent for many reasons. It is an important power, the numbers that you deal with in terms of the population, the human resource, the human capacity. And I think in many ways, and this is why a lot of the broader, greater powers from the West, the US and others, and even in the Middle East, take interest in that country because if managed well, it is in many ways also the driver of peace and security in the Horn. So that if it is not managed well, it could also turn out to be the driver for stability in the region, in much the same way as it is also a driver for peace and security. If you look at the neighboring countries, Eritrea, Sudan, Kenya, Ethiopia, Somalia, and to some extent Egypt, even the Middle East, it's an important country because of its sheer size and geographical location itself. So it must concern us, and that's why it's good that Rich Father, you convene this meeting. If the efforts of the rest of Africa and the world to support the country resolve its tension is muted or somewhat weak, when a big issue has come, many of us would have noticed that, yes, there have been some efforts by the AU, but I don't think that it is commensurate to the urgency one would expect, given the ramifications that could happen if this crisis is not resolved quickly. I know that the AU, as I said, have made some efforts, and also some powers of the world have made some efforts, but it is safe to say that the effort is not exactly, as I said, significant as to measure up to what we need. I think there are different dimensions for that. One, of course, I'll come back to that, is exactly if you look at what is the nature and character of the African Union, are not yet strongly embedded in the ways of working or do not even impact significantly on the behavior of the African Union. So I think that's an important thing in itself. So the first thing around the AU is that it is first and foremost, it tends sometimes unconsciously or consciously becomes a platform where mostly governments share common things and common fears, and therefore also to that extent becomes a club of peers who protect themselves. And then for a long time, right from the OAU, there's this clause around the non-interference of the internal affairs of the state. But I think that that is something that sometimes falls through the cracks because, as we all know, nothing is really ever very internal. And I think for the case of Ethiopia, it becomes complicated because this issue of identity politics within Ethiopia and the region, of course, is important. There are different forms of nationalisms, which shows up even in the character, as Rashid was saying, on how civil society in the entire width and breadth of Ethiopian society looks like. And so we cannot look at civil society independent of these identity dimensions in Ethiopia. That's an important element to look at, and how it also relates to governance, to politics, to economics as well, how the national economy is structured, to the dignities associated with it. And therefore, of course, it also conversely translates into fear of control by one group or the other. I think that there are also deep-rooted things around appropriation. We know that although there have been efforts, especially on investment in education and social services and all that, we know that there's still, like is the case in many countries in the continent and to some extent in the world as well, there's a lot of there are inequalities as well for historical reasons and for many other regions as well around the region. So I think in terms of what there's agency for the AU, there's agency for African leaders to play more, but as I said, I think that is going to rely a lot to the extent that the agency of people and civil society are bearing on the character of that state so that there's enough voice to make sure that the AU itself, the leadership of the AU and the member states are responding to the demands from the African people and African civil society, and most importantly, the people of Ethiopia in their totality. So I think that this is important, that there has to be more work, hard work, I think more purposeful hard work to encourage peace and faster resolution of the conflict, and then not sticking to this idea that I said is the non-interference of internal affairs, because in the bigger picture of things, this is not only internal, it has dimensions that are regional. I think that there are forces for good within different entities in Ethiopia itself, including, as I said, civil society and the church, as Rashid was saying. Those should be find ways to do and speak a bit more and seek more collaborative ways, if not even both behind the scenes or even direct engagement, including, I think, some of the heads of state. We need to have an understanding of the power dynamic within that space. I think that the issue of practical needs of people, food, security, livelihoods, even communication, should be protected, I think, in the region that is most impacted at the moment, because issues of humanitarian access is key to retain goodwill as well. And I think that that's the only way you build peace. If people are meeting basic needs, then they can be on the table. We know that there are quite a number of NGOs as well who are part of that force, but I think there's quite a bit of work that needs to be done to protect that as well. I think that's important. And then I think the issue of integration of the region needs to, yeah, as I said, it's the character of it depends on how it is formed and the ways of working. But until people are interested in the way this, whether it is IGAD or AU, I think it's going to be important. Lastly, I think, is the issue of understanding. There are many externalized analyses that sometimes is off the mark on what the problem is. So I think that the academia from the region, people from the region need to have more deliberate efforts to understand what is the real cause, not necessarily what is on the headlines. In the region, so that we play that again is sometimes generalized off-the-mark externalized analysis. I think that's what I could say for now.
Thank you, Peter. I think, you know, you've laid out a lot of very many different dynamics that need to be taken into account. You know, there's identity politics, there's regional dynamics, there's power dynamics within the country itself, there's the agency of the AU and the power of the AU, and I guess how they're also constituted as an organization with their stance of non-interference, but still trying to engage, and I would imagine have some closed door or behind the scenes diplomacy to try to get some kind of settlement in this conflict, especially as Ethiopia is a person, an important country in the region. And I think it's necessary for them to really try and make sure that this comes to a settlement, as both you and Rashid have said. Having looked at those two sides of the coin, I think right now I'd like to bring in Kibreb. Kibreb, you're based in Ethiopia, you are in Ethiopia. And maybe just to talk to us where you think, you know, the civil society is situated within Ethiopia. We've heard Rashid talk about the structure of the civil society in Ethiopia, you know, not being as strong, you know, due to a very strong government, being fragmented along ethnic lines. And, you know, there are deep splits within the civil society. So it's not a monolith. Where do you situate, especially the national civil society, not looking at the international ones, in this conflict in Ethiopia currently?
Thank you for the opportunity. Let me start with some background so that I can respond to the question that you raised. I think whenever we think about problems in the area of intervention that we can contribute as civil societies in general and civil society organizations in particular, it's very much important to understand the context and also the facts on the ground. So that would very much be important. Otherwise, it's going to be misleading, and wherever a proposed solution has worked might not work on the similar or in a relatively similar problem that we are seeing. So that's why I wanted to provide some background with regards to what the context is. So one very important point is, as most of the African countries, Ethiopia is highly affected by corruption, grand corruption, and specifically related with illicit financial flow. So in this aspect, actually, Ethiopia has lost, until 2009, it has lost almost $11 billion, which is a very huge amount of money. And on the other hand, until 2014, the Global Financial Integrity has shown in its research that on an annual basis, 1.2 up to 3.1 billion USD was flowing out of the country on a yearly basis or on annual basis. So I am raising this issue because when we discuss about this matter, I want to emphasize on the existence of a deep state and deep state actors in the country. And these actors manifested or had very much strong holding since 6 years back when Prime Minister Hailemariam was in power. So This deep state wants to have a very soft leader who will be acting as a puppet and who will be dealing with the ceremonial role while the other things are handled by these deep state actors. So the deep state actors do have some official positions like the Central Intelligence Office and other roles, and also there are informal and non-formal actors in the country. So these deep state actors were highly controlling the corruption chain in the country. So due to that reason, whenever there are civil societies, individuals who are acting against and who are doing investigative journalism works were highly and brutally attacked for many years. I'm providing this background because, the conflict that's happening in the country has got direct relation with this corruption chain and the deep state actors. So after that, then when the change came, as Peter said, everyone in the country was highly hopeful about the change, the democratization, and the existence and development of more strong civil societies. So everyone was expecting that, but at the end, the problem start to pop up from these deep state actors that laws should not be changed. For example, the civil society law was highly opposed by these deep state actors not to be amended. So the civil society law that got enacted in 2009 was highly suppressive, and then it formed its very weak civil societies, which were only striving to exist rather than do significant activities. And also other civil societies, cultural and also churches, were highly affected. And even these deep state actors infiltrated into the religious organs, and they were trying to attack those people who are demanding positive change in the country. We have got large number of cases which was taken to court, but at the end, these people were released after the change came. So this background is very important because I'm going to jump in after the change happened. Then some of the deep state actors directly started to engage in creating conflicts in the country. And then this caused, almost until now, there were 113 conflicts that took lives of people and that caused internal migration in the country. Then after that, the major actors in the deep state, which were also members of the TPLF, started disobeying the government boldly. So these people started to deny the government and the public prosecutor and the court even, which tried to arrest some people who participated in grave human rights abuses. And then the regional administration said no towards the court order, and this was a very big breach of law. And on the other hand, it instituted regional electoral commission, still against the constitution. And then finally, this regional administration and partly the deep state actors started to say that after October, there is no federal government that's going to be in control. So all people will have a role to order the army and other state apparatuses, which was really wrong. Due to this reason, tension started to be very big. And the government, believing that it could crack corruption, and it decided to print a new currency note, which was, the way I see it, is an immediate cause for the conflict. Because there was a data that there is a very huge amount of currency which is not recognized by the National Bank, but operating within the market. So this action was one of the things that might have caused things to have more tension. And finally, as the federal government said, there was an attack on the federal army, which was accepted by leaders of the TPLF. So this caused the conflict. And after the conflict, 75% of the total arms in the country was located in the Northern Command, and this group had the ability to control that. So during this time, there was an action from the federal government, which immediately started the conflict. And then here we are in a two-sided conflict, but at last the federal government has announced that it has totally controlled the overall region with the exception of very small areas. So when I go back to Rashid's point, actually churches are not divided and even religious organs like mosques are not divided. Rather, they are coming out of the deep split that happened before the last 2 years. So the previous administration and the deep state worked actually hard to split and then control and hijack these institutions. But now this is getting healed. But on the other hand, when Rashid said that churches were splitted and the Coptic church in Amhara and the Coptic church in Tigray was the way he expressed it. But the way I see it from two dimensions. One is, actually, there is no Coptic church called Amhara, so it's the Ethiopian Coptic Orthodox Church, and that administration totally has boldly favored the government's action. And then, on the other hand, church leaders in the Tigray region have said differently. But at the end of the day, churches will be laid in different principles from governments. So there is the principle of secularity, and in this principle of secularity, of course, churches by no means can support conflicts and war because their teaching and principle is too much different from the way governments and state operates. So it's obvious that this type of ideas can be differently reflected. But at the end, the way I see it, in civil society organizations as well, there are national civil society organizations and there are international. So as the government is very much cautious about its sovereignty and the sovereignty of the state, it may be very much cautious about the intervention of international actors at this level. So basically, the national civil society organizations who should be very much strong and who should challenge positively and who should be able to side the truths and the principles. That way, I think things will get solution. Thank you.
Thanks, Kibra. And I think there's a couple of things you've mentioned that I think would be interesting to interrogate further as we go along. But Rita, I'd like to bring you in now to sort of talk to us a little bit about, you know, the civil society space shrinking and the quick turnaround that happened when there was that slight opening window where there was sort of space to act as civil society. And something Kibra and Rashid have also touched on, which is the role of religious organizations and the church in Ethiopia.
Okay, thank you very much, everybody, and all my previous panel speakers. I am the secretary for the Horn of Africa Forum for Civil Society, and like many of the other speakers before me have mentioned, in 2018, the civil society organizations in the Horn and our members were very excited to see what was happening in Ethiopia. We thought, okay, you know, we are seeing a prime minister who is engaging in a kind of reconciliation process, a reconstruction process. We are seeing a prime minister who has freed political prisoners, who then welcomed back a number of political opponents who had been stationed in neighboring countries. And there were political agreements, if you like, very public political agreements in that process. We're also very excited about seeing somebody like Daniel Bekele being appointed as a person in charge of the Ethiopian Human Rights Commission, somebody that we all recognize with having an extensive experience in human rights. We're very excited about the number of women appointed at different government departments and in different roles within Ethiopia. And finally, but not least, you know, there was the start of the peace process that started with Eritrea. When Prime Minister Abiy first came into power, one of the things he did, which also was very exciting in terms of freedom of expression and freedom of information, you know, was that quite a number of internet websites that had been blocked off or were not accessible were actually now accessible. So this was, you know, this was a new Ethiopia in that context, which is very exciting. The other thing is he undertook to amend or change key legislation. So one of the key legislations in this regard was actually the civil society legislation, which did get amended and actually provided more space. The other legislation he had promised to change was the press freedom legislation, which basically hasn't gone anywhere. So that's the process inside of this thing. We also agree with something Rashid said, that all of this openness was really great. However, the big gap in this process of opening up has actually encouraged debate and discussion, etc., etc. But there were no actual steps taken to actually strengthen the civil society along the way. Okay, there was a lot of liberalization, but no account was actually taken in this process of many years of kind of reducing and clamping down on civil society. So we have a political opening process with no counterpart sort of strengthening and building of the civil society. So then there is a gap, because political debates get very heated and very polarized, but then there is nobody in the system with the capacity to mediate this, much as maybe in the past, some of the elders of the communities would have done, because even that structure is not really there in place. So then we are facing quite a lot of problems, because what we're starting to see is polarization along ethnic lines, but not because of land disputes, because of past grievances that people wanted addressed, may not have been addressed, and these things have sort of come up. So then we start to get the reversal process, you know, from opening to sort of closing. So, you know, we then get in September, you know, already in September 2019, we start to get the first internet lockdowns and mobile lockdowns because of ongoing protests that had happened at that time. And when we move down to this year, you know, we see after Hundessa was killed, we see Ethiopia completely locked down for a month, right? No internet, no mobile. This sort of environment, then, while it is created in order to try and control hate speech, this sort of environment actually encourages speculation, fake news, disinformation, misinformation, and actually creates more problems than was planned. We also start to see a process where political leaders are arrested in mass. After Hundessa was killed, there were almost 7,000 people arrested. We see that protests deteriorate into violence, and then we have many people killed. So this is a very, very concerning trend, which is only getting worse right now with the Tigray conflict, because whilst it's not the whole of Ethiopia that is under internet and mobile lockdown, Tigray is definitely locked down. There is no access, humanitarian access or otherwise, at the moment, subject to ICRC, who is actually present at the moment. So the lack of information feeds into a whole process of paranoia, misinformation, and disinformation. There is also, in this process of civil society, we have to include media, not only the religious. And in the media side of things, yes, you know, we start to see Ethiopian Broadcasting Corporation actually starting to talk more about human rights and even raise issues of corruption. But what we are seeing right now within this conflict is that they're basically towing the official government line. So issues about humanitarian access, protection of civilians, etc., are not necessarily being raised. We even see the Peace Commission within Ethiopia, which is a very interesting and certainly an interesting body, supporting this war. So in terms of civil society, it raises big issues inside the country. When we're talking about the faith-based organizations, Khalid Kibrab is right. You know, Ethiopia is a secular state. So faith-based organizations have a role, not so much in dictating or anything, but they have a role as any other civil society to bring to attention, you know, issues of society and culture and such things. So basically, there is a division because, as Kibrab clearly said, the Ethiopian Orthodox Church officially supports the government's position. This is not the position of all faith-based organizations in Ethiopia. Some of them, the Intercollegiate Association of the Faith-Based Organizations, has issued a statement basically saying that, you know, to resolve this conflict, there needs to be a cessation of hostilities and there needs to be negotiation, and the lives of the people have to be protected. So this is, again, maybe a polarization, but it is there. On the issue of the Orthodox Church in Eritrea, it is actually silent at the moment. for very specific reasons to the context in Eritrea. The Eritrean Orthodox Church that has spoken to push for a sort of cessation of fire, humanitarian corridors, negotiation, is the Eritrean Orthodox Church in the diaspora in Northern America. The Eritrean Catholic Church has definitely spoken out and shared a peace letter, basically with the point of saying, you know, that war only destroys, it doesn't build. And the regional Catholic bishops, the Amasea, have also really requested and advised that war does not solve issues, it destroys people. So the concern here also is that whilst it is correct and appropriate for a country to target corruption issues within its territory and deal with such issues, the concern now is that this is developing more and more towards a kind of ethnic targeting of certain groups within the country, which raises similar, you know, this is not the first time this has happened in Ethiopia. If we go back to 1998, when the war with Eritrea first broke out, there was similar action taken. And none of that actually brought any positive result to anybody. So the key factor here is that whilst understanding that corruption issues must be dealt with and constitutional issues must be dealt with, the key factor here is that most civil society in the region also is very concerned about the impact of this war outside of Ethiopia. We are starting to see this in Sudan with 40,000 or so refugees. We're starting to see security concerns from the perspective of Kenya, Somalia, and South Sudan as Ethiopian peacekeepers are withdrawn or frozen. So basically, this is why there is a push from the regional civil societies also to look at cessation of hostilities, negotiation, humanitarian corridors, and more involvement from the African Union and those regional bodies who are actually responsible for regional security. Thank you.
Thank you, Rita. Peter, on the role of the diaspora civil society, or as Rita mentioned, religious organizations, from your perspective and point of view, do you think they would be able to help or, you know, lend their voice and energy to this cause? Would they be listened to, or are these same divisions that have been sort of raised also follow them in the diaspora?
Thanks very much, Pauline. I think that the crisis that we see in the Horn, the epicenter being Ethiopia at the moment, is something that requires all efforts. There's nothing that must be left out, whether those are, you know, the diaspora, people within the faith organizations, and I think, as I said, most importantly, also the governments and the leadership in the region and the people of the region. I think that there's need for a lot of concerted effort. As I said again, it is shocking a bit, it is surprising that not as much is being spoken about. There's quite some indifference and a sort of a wish that things would resolve themselves. There's nothing that is internal, everything has a dimension. I think that's what needs. And I think that it is also important to locate it within what are the fears among the different people involved, both within and without the country. Fear over loss of power, fear over what is seen to be economic gains. Those are things that need to find their place in the table as well. And as you know, that these are things that are driven largely by, you know, those are the root causes, how the resources in the region, in the country are appropriated. And therefore, political power is seen as a means to do that. So I think it's important to address that. But most important to realize that even as we delay from morning to tomorrow, there are people, women, children who are suffering out of the same. We must be able to make efforts to make sure that we protect as much lives as possible. And that's what is important. And then these discussions can be held. And most importantly, the regional integration around issues of trade and things that happen within this region, there has to be efforts in that direction as well. And to know that sometimes interests, both of neighbors and those who are far, can be helpful, and sometimes they are not very helpful. Mm-hmm. So I think that there's need within the IGAD, within the AU, to make sure that first within Ethiopia, what is the aggregated national interest of Ethiopia as a country with that rich history that all of us are proud of? What is the need for IGAD as a region? What is our aggregated strategic interests as a region? Are these well articulated? Are we clear about this? or we are mixing things up. So I think that, yeah, bottom line is there has to be more effort than we're seeing.
Thank you, Peter. And again, thank you for your time. I think, Rashid, there's a question here that is for you. Tibebu asks, the government claims it is the TPLF who cut communication. Do you have any evidence when you say the government caused communication blackout? And as you answer that, Rashid, I think there's another question also for you that's not on the Q&A, that is asking if there's a danger of regional destabilization because of the conflict in Ethiopia. Of course, now with movement of displaced people or refugees going into Sudan, South Sudan, and maybe Ethiopia withdrawing their troops from Onsom, is this conflict going to have much wider regional destabilizing effects? Rashid.
Yes, thank you very much, Pauline. I think the question about the cuts in communication sounds to me like a frivolous question because it is the government that controls the infrastructure. It is the government that routinely cuts off mobile telephones, cuts off the internet and everything else whenever there is a crisis. And this is not the first time. So the idea that it is the TPLF that has done that probably is not entirely correct. There could be, I think, possibility that the regional government had its own, I think, sort of input into that structure. But I think Ethiopia is a very centralized state and communication is very centralized. So, you know, unless it is Addis that has cut it, there's no way in which, you know, you will have a regional government cut its own internet. And, you know, it is a very centralized, I think, system. And I'm not competent in this field. I will probably, you know, not dwell too much on it. But I think that this is definitely something which the state intended. And I think you can see the impact. The impact has been horrendous, you know, because I am now in my 50s and I've never seen a conflict which has been fought for 4 weeks without any report, without any footage. And that is remarkable. I think what Ethiopia has achieved may be a template for all future wars that dictators will fight everywhere. You know, how to impose a total, complete blackout. Coming to the second question about the wider impact, there's no doubt in my mind that this war is going to be extremely destabilizing for a number of reasons, because Tigray straddles basically two frontiers. This is Sudan, but also Eritrea. And in many ways, the war today, you know, there is a lot of others deciding to go against a rebel state. Eritrea is deeply involved in this conflict. And the longer it continues to drag on, the greater the possibility of actually this war sucking in other regional actors as well. Now, Western Tigray borders a region of Sudan, which is called Kassala. And down Gedarif, these are two regions that are extremely unstable in Sudan, essentially no man's land in many ways, where the state does not have, you know, presence, where also historically there have been conflicts between ethnic communities, but also a lot of other criminal syndicates, you know, gun running, people smuggling. So it is a very difficult terrain for the governments to control. And, you know, my sense is that if this war drags, it will actually expand to Sudan. But what worries me a lot is not just the outward expansion of this conflict, but the inward expansion of this conflict. Ethiopia is a vast country and it has a lot of discontents. It has a lot of ethnic fragmentations. And although the prime minister may sound a bit triumphalist at the moment and appear to have vanquished a historical foe, I think no one doubts that this is a very fragile state, largely reliant on a very small support base. So if this war, I think, escalates, there's a very greater chance it may actually extend to other ethnic communities. But I think what is extremely worrying for me, apart from everything else, is the possibility of this war actually developing into some kind of genocide. And I use this word carefully. I don't want to sound alarmist, but there is growing ethnic profiling of Tigrayans. There are already mass killings. We saw a nasty incident at the start of the war in Maikadra. And so ethnic tensions are extremely high. And if you don't have a robust government that comes in and basically puts a stop to this, and a government that encourages this kind of ethnic profiling, where Tigrayans are actually expelled from work, they are stopped from traveling, they basically get letters saying they should not report for work. We don't know the exact number, but hundreds of them. There is a lot of anecdotal evidence that is mounting to an extent where there was a BBC report last evening, which actually quoted one Western diplomat are saying there is a smell of Rwanda. You know, so I think we must not be complacent. Rwanda did not drop from Mars. You know, it is part of the habitat. It is part of the terrain. There's nothing special about Ethiopia. It is a country that has had historical iniquities and now deeply fragmented, and the ethnic tensions are very high. So I think unless you have a government that basically stands up and looks at this growing dynamics and stops it, then the risk, I think, is very high. I think this war also needs some real action from Africans. And there's generally a deference to Ethiopia because it is the headquarters of the African Union. But I think because of that status itself, I think Africa should pay a lot of attention to Ethiopia, put a lot of pressure on these parties to come round and find a political settlement. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Rashid, for that comprehensive answer. But I think there's still a bit of debate, I guess, in the group about who cut off the communication. There's another question here for Kibreb, and it says, Kibreb, the deep state is still here in different shapes and forms, even after the removal of TPLF. After the reform being in quotation marks, there was space for civil society to operate and bring diverse views, but civil society was largely absent. Why? I'm afraid we'll be speaking of the same thing even after certain years. So Kibreb, over to you, that even though the deep state is there and there's room for reform, it seems like civil society is still absent.
Before I answer that question, I want to provide comment on Rashid's response with regards to power, phone, and maybe Eritrea's intervention as well. I mean, some of the things when he answered, he was assuming facts. And when we speak about a nation with 100 million people, assumption, I don't think is a right way of responding to that. So I think there are two sides of allegations. One, the federal government claims that in order to attack its, the federal army, the TPLF itself cut power and telecommunication and all other means of communication. So there is this side of the story, and also the TPLF claims that it's the government. But at the end of the day, Ethiopia do have different substations with regards to power. So of course, to disconnect power, there is no need for the central intervention. Rather, in the region itself, disconnection could be made. So still, it's going to be fact disputes, different wordings, but at the end of the day, from Rashid's point, I have seen significant assumption. I don't think that's a correct way of doing it. But with regards to the deep state, actually, the old guards of the previous administration were still operating, and there were, as I said earlier, there were 113 conflicts all over the country, which had ethnic and religious resemblance. And during these processes, there are some signs of financing whereby youth would be paid to go out and attack. And there were some information related with actually youth who were caught with having cash received to do things that happened in the country. So that's why I'm saying that when you see the problem and discuss about the problem, it's more deeper than what people are seeing from the outside. The major advocate of ethnic federalism and ethnic politics is actually the TPLF. So a party, and if a team is organized in a form of ethnic basis, then at the end, if there is an alleged crime that is done by group members of that party, of course, when you arrest, for sure, if you are going to arrest 10 people, all 10 of them are going to have the same ethnic background. It's obvious that that's going to happen. So, I mean, the ethnic profiling issue is popping up because political parties are organized in a form of ethnic groups. And when you get assignment in the federal and regional administrations still, your ethnic background is seen. So at the end, when you go and try to apprehend people, of course, they are going to be from a certain ethnic group. That's right. So that's the downfall, or that's the effect, or the negative effects of ethnic federalism. Because, you know, when you see TPLF, it's Tigray Liberation Front. There is another party which is with the Oromos. There is another party with the Somalis. So this is what has happened in the country. And if you say that there has been a wrongdoing by certain members of that specific party, of course, you are going to apprehend or imprison members of that ethnic group. So that's the issue and which needs to be seen. With regards to the deep state matter, actually, these previous officials who were aggrieved and who were unhappy by the reform, significant portion of them went to Tigray region, and then they were settling there. And they were preaching on a daily basis that Tigray people and TPLF are the same. And there were different parties who were saying that this is a very wrongful argument that's being portrayed, which is, you know, TPLF is a one party and there are other opposition parties operating from that region. But still, TPLF was advocating that, you know, TPLF and Tigray people are the same. So that was one wrongful thing that has been happening over the last 2 years. So in the deep state aspect, actually, this corruption chain in the country was actually financing conflicts all over the country. There are different evidences that could be tracked, and there are use that has been used for this purpose. So that group wanted, especially the small group within TPLF, was trying to prove that Tigray is a very peaceful island while the other part of the country is in conflict. So that was the message which wanted to be portrayed, which was really wrong, because at the end, you know, this type of conflict happened specifically in Tigray area. All in all, what I can say is, in order for countries to be safe and for the rule of law to materialize and have flesh, there should be a strong government without an actor of a deep state. So that needs to happen, and that will be a solution. And with regards to intervention, actually, the way I see it, the action from group members of TPLF has shaken the state, not the government. It has shaken the state. And now the state is trying to protect its peace, security, and sovereignty. So the way I see it, it's almost over, and now Ethiopia has stabilized itself. There could be insurgent actions that might happen in the country, but at the end, it's going to be over very soon. That's what I see and understand. One point with regards to protection of civilians, I 100% agree with that. And with regards to humanitarian corridors, I 100% concur with that idea. So immediate opening towards humanitarian corridors needs to happen right away. And protection of civilians, it's nothing to discuss about. I mean, it's very much important, and the government needs to respect those things.
Thank you, Kibrep. I think there's a follow-up question on that, but I just want to ask a question to Rita, but also a follow-up question that maybe we should be thinking about, which are quite similar. Somebody says, KMRB is a former army intelligence officer and a long-term cadre of the EPRDF. Why is the notion of deep state limited to TPLF? And I think that's also the same question that is being asked about. It is not only TPLF that was part of the deep state or the corruption, and members of other groups also being arrested. There's a question that I want to pose to you, Rita. Judy asks, both you and Rashid have talked about the positions of the Coptic and Catholic churches in Ethiopia. Mm-hmm. Are Protestant churches taking any position in the situation in Tigray?
The Protestant churches have not issued a public statement yet. However, this does not mean that they are not working with their communities or within their communities and within the structure of their communities and their congregations towards a kind of peace-building exercise. They are very concerned about some of the fragmentation that Rashid mentioned, even within their own congregations. So they are very focused also on mending some of that. So they haven't issued a public statement, but this does not mean that they're not actually working or doing work at the grassroots level with their congregations on issues of peace building.
Thank you, Rita. Rashida, I know you want to answer Kibrib's comments and other comments, but I'd like to pose this question to you. Much of the TPLF's current top leadership is probably too old to go back to the bush and fight a new insurgency inside Ethiopia. So much will depend on the intentions of the next generation of the TPLF leadership. Do they intend to fight or to return to politics under a new banner and contest the elections in 2021?
Thank you very much, Pauline. And also my thanks to the colleagues for their submissions. I just want to just stress again the point which I made, which is that the idea of ethnic profiling is very bad. Even if you have legitimate security concerns, I think that is how serious violence against specific communities happen. And I think the Ethiopian Human Rights Commission itself, headed by Daniel Bekele, has actually expressed concern. So this is not, I think, the way my brother Kebreab is trying to downplay it. This is a very serious matter. And I think I can't stress enough how concerning it is. And if it continues, I think, in this trend without the Prime Minister coming out very openly and clearly putting a stop to it, then I think there is no doubt in my mind that Ethiopia is headed for serious violence ahead. We shouldn't downplay it. I would love to believe that everything is over and perfect. This war has been wrapped up. Unfortunately, history tells us that wars are not like taps where you turn them on and then you turn it off. Wars generate a dynamic of their own. You know, they leave toxic legacies. This is going to be a very long, drawn out process. I wish this war had not taken place, but now that we are in it, how do we stop it? And I think the onus is, first of all, on Prime Minister Abiy and his government. Do they want to stabilize Tigray? If they want to stabilize Tigray, then they need to take the political action now. I can't see how this war can be resolved without at least some form of negotiations with Tigray, the civil society involvement, and even the insurgency itself. Ultimately, the same people you criminalize and you want to take to court will be the same people you'll have to sit face-to-face with and negotiate peace with. They are the people who have the arms. They are the people who can complicate life for the federal government. So I think we should try to look at it from that perspective. Again, I dispute the entire thesis of Kebreab, which is that there is a deep state which the TPLF was part of. I think if you look at the idea of a deep, Ethiopia was an imperial state, centuries old, has developed a certain ethos and a certain culture and tradition. So this is a very strong state fundamentally. And now historically, it has been controlled and governed by Highlanders, in particular the Amhara, but also at some point by the Tigrayans. But it has largely throughout its imperial history been led by the Amhara. And we have seen how the Amhara have become today the most strident, belligerent party, which is pushing Abiy to go to war with Tigray. And I would even argue that they are indeed part of the deep state and not even the TPLF. But I think, I don't want to get into all these, controversial issues, but to say that the idea of a deep state led by TPLF, which is still fighting back, I think is quite spurious in my view.
I think the second bit, Rashid, of the question that actually somebody had asked before, and I don't think you have answered, was the next generation of the TPLF leadership. I know we don't have a crystal ball to look at what we're going to do, but from, I guess, history and what we know, just an analysis is, do you think that they intend to fight or would they return to politics?
I love that question because, TPLF has been in power for 30 years. The old historical core of the TPLF is gone, people like Mele Zenawi. But I think you have probably still people who have been in combat, people like Debretsion Gebremichael. But I think it is quite a valid question. You have a party that has been in power for 30 years, has become accustomed to a life of ease, has been softened up by power. So it is very unlikely that you will have the same tenacity and the same resilience that they used to have in the past. And I would even think that part of the military operation, how quick it was, clearly suggests that TPLF is not what it claimed it was. But I think we must be careful about that kind of analysis because there's a lot of uncertainty about it. TPLF still, first of all, it has the ethos and the tradition of actually a guerrilla insurgency, of an insurgency. Then you also have the bitterness which has been left by war and also a public that has galvanized around it because of the fact that they perceive themselves as targeted as an ethnicity and not simply Tigray. And I think in many ways, the public support for TPLF has actually grown much more than in the past. So this is an insurgency with a lot of mileage. We should not completely rule it out and dismiss it as no longer part of the equation.
Rita, I just wanted to ask about the Tigrayan conflict being the flashpoint, but there's conflict in other places in Ethiopia. And I just wondered maybe if you can just highlight a little bit of what is going on then around Ethiopia. And if this many fronts are possibly opening, would really civil society in Ethiopia and maybe regionally or internationally, having the background of a civil society in Ethiopia, will they be able to mitigate or advocate for a cessation of hostilities, not only in Tigray?
I think my colleague Kibreb also mentioned that there are at least 113 different flashpoints that have happened in the last while, you know, all over Ethiopia that are ethnic-based conflicts. His analysis, based on his analysis of a deep state, is that many of these conflicts have been generated, etc., or facilitated by the TPLF. I think this is still an issue that really needs to be looked at more deeply, right? Because, you know, one of the key conflicts that happened, you know, just recently also was also about on the role of Addis Ababa, right? The Oromo discussion about Addis Ababa, Finfine, and, you know, Addis Ababa as a capital city, how is it to be grown and who is to manage it, etc. I cannot actually see that, you know, the TPLF would in any way really be interested in that sort of conflict, except as part of the government as it was then. But, you know, so you have something like that also that is happening because the dialogue that needs to happen about what Ethiopia should look like, etc., etc., cannot be directed top down. So civil society could have a role in that sort of process, in the grassroots sort of process of bringing communities together and, you know, facilitating the work of the elders in terms of, you know, their relationship with the youth and so on and so forth. So there is that role, but that can only happen if what's happening is a dialogue that's looking at grievances, reconciliation, and is honestly looking at inclusiveness, which may not be happening when the dialogue is unity at all costs. The interpretation of unity at all costs, certainly from, you know, from some quarters in Ethiopia, would be assimilation. So that is a dangerous discussion. So civil society does have a role, but there has to be a dialogue that's going on. It cannot happen in a vacuum. So I hope that answers part of the question.
Thank you so much, Rita. We're steadily running out of time, but I'd like to bring you in, Kibreb, now just with a question that I sort of like you to answer as you wrap up. So there's a question here that talks that says, you know, we haven't talked at all about the prospect of returning to a path towards elections, this having been at the center of how the conflict escalated. What are the odds of coming to a genuine democratic process from here? With the TPLF out of the picture, should Prime Minister Abiy not have every reason to allow a free contest now? And Kibreb, I'd sort of like you to answer this and comment on any other questions that were sort of raised for you. Thank you.
Great. Let me start with two brief comments. Still, you know, one comment raised by Rashid, which says that TPLF do have large public support. This is still assumption. We need to have a public opinion and get it, because the government, on the other hand, claims that when the army was getting into the different parts of Tigray, it was getting high support. So still, it's going to be a contested matter. So I want to say that. The ethnic profiling aspect by no means is going to be acceptable. I mean, under the guise of highly ethnic organized party, but still, you know, the government by no means should, or in any way should, do an ethnic profiling, and even any organization as well. This is illegal, and this is not acceptable. So I really concur with the reports of the Human Rights Commission of Ethiopia. So definitely, this is a very wrong thing. So I want to do that. But with regards to civil societies, you know, after a long period of suppressive administration, now civil societies started to reorganize themselves. So the ones which are formed in a form of organization like civil society organization, they are getting registered, re-registered, and trying to organize themselves so that they can be of strong importance. This is the period where we are, and I know several civil societies which got the opportunity, you know, after getting the legal amendment, they are working hard in getting registered and mobilizing people. So that needs to be understood. But something that needs to also be recognized is there are different political parties in Tigray region which are actually pushed out by TPLF, but which do have large support by the public. For example, the person who started or organized the TPLF itself. That person has organized one party and he went to Tigray, and then there was a public support, but at the end they organized youth and then they evicted him from Tigray, and he is based now in Addis, and he is trying to mobilize. And there are other youth groups, other youth parties as well, which are operating still, which are thrown out by TPLF and then being operating and waiting for the right moment to jump in. So when you think about TPLF, by the way, while TPLF was in Addis, the parliament was 100% controlled by EPRDF, which TPLF is part of it. And then TPLF went to Tigray and it highly supported the immediate action for election. And after the election, TPLF won 98 or 99% of the seats in the parliament. Imagine the other parties which are thrown out of Tigray wanted to, they were told not to participate. So, you know, this is what has happened on the ground. So this needs to be seen very well. All in all, the way I see it is that this action of the government is a crackdown of a deep state and corruption. So this is something that will protect the state, Ethiopia, and its sovereignty as well, so that it can exist. Because the TPLF totally denied the existence of the federal government, and then the federal system was in great jeopardy. Then afterwards, now the federal system seems to be more stable than ever. But at the end, as I said earlier, you know, humanitarian corridors and protection of civilians and the existence of any form of ethnic profiling is illegal, and that needs to stop immediately. So I fully support that, yeah.
Europe, I still need you to answer this question just very briefly, if you may, and I think I'll ask all panelists to give me a very brief answer to this. So are there prospects of returning to a pathway towards elections? Is there a possibility of a democratic process from this point on?
For me, yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. Totally. I totally agree with that. Because one, the country previously, because of COVID, was in a state of emergency. And there are large tens of countries which postponed their election. But, you know, Ethiopia is one of them. So it's not an evil to postpone an election because of a pandemic that's shaking the whole world. And that's highly affecting even the more civilized world. So election is not a nominal thing that you will do in a country like Ethiopia without gathering large number of crowds, because that's how we operate. So it's very important to have crowds and large number of people to get around. So now I will be expecting democratic election by June. If not, then I will assume that there is an interest from the government that it wants to override the election. But I will be expecting, because, you know, constitutionally, the constitutional body and the House of Federation and the House of People's Representatives boldly recognized that this election needs to be postponed because of the COVID impact. Mm-hmm. So if there is any way that this will be postponed any more than, you know, June, July, then it's going to be something that is going to be wrong in light with the constitution, in light with the decision of the most powerful organs in the country, the House of People's Representative and the House of Federation. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Rita, I'd like to pose another question to you. So we have two other questions that I think would be important to answer, actually. So the first question is, looking ahead, if the provisional Tigray regional government is imposed in practice, to what extent will it be accepted by Tigray civil society or treated as an alien government?
That's a very tough question, because my thinking is much more aligned with Rashid's, is that whilst within Tigray, et cetera, there would have been, you know, maybe issues even with the TPLF, and certainly there were new political parties arising and, you know, kind of maybe, you know, starting to find their feet and starting to sort of act, I think the dynamics of the war changes that discussion quite deeply. And people integrate, whether we think that, the election was, you know, very much one-sided, et cetera, did vote. The other interesting thing is that the media blackout also made it very difficult, right, for people to see footage, et cetera, of the Tigray voting. Mm-hmm. Although some journalists did manage to get through and some footage did make it out, and people voted within a COVID, taking into account COVID and taking in the spacing, etc., etc., showing quite clearly that people do not need to mass in crowds, and people, if prepared, can actually follow rules and be disciplined, right? So I think before this conflict, there probably was room for sort of discussions, etc., etc. Now I think that room is really narrowed because there's 40,000 Tigrayans who are in a refugee camp because of the military action over and out.
Thank you. Rashid, your thoughts on this question, also just to wrap up. So Abiy's vision for a unitary state seems to be based on continued centralization of state and power. But should a balkanization of Ethiopia take place, do you think truly decentral forms of federalism still have a chance? For example, confederalism. Rashid?
Yes, but if I may, I would like to answer the question of postponing the elections first. Mm-hmm. It sounds to me very ironic that you can cancel an election because of COVID, but then you can go to war and displace tens of thousands. So that tells to you that it isn't COVID that actually, you know, is the real reason why Abiy canceled the elections. I think there are other bigger dynamics at play. Clearly, we have a prime minister, I think, who has calculated that he runs the risk of losing. And I think one issue that hasn't been raised here during this discussion is Oromia. The last, I think, 2 years in particular, we have seen extraordinary security campaign in Oromia, which has displaced actually thousands as well. Inter-ethnic violence and hostilities have risen sharply in Oromia. We have seen massive crackdown on the opposition. The entire leadership of Oromia is now in jail. So this is not a prime minister who has created the context for actually free and fair elections. We are beginning to see the return of an old Ethiopia, an Ethiopia of law and order. Actually, the operation against Tigray was called Operation Law and Order. Nowhere in the world have we seen a law and order operation in which a government deploys tanks, missiles, and aeroplanes against its own citizens. So that, I think, is the reality. On the road ahead, I don't see any prospect for any democratization in Ethiopia anytime soon. That could happen, you know, along the line. I think you have a prime minister, first of all, who has lost any democratic instinct that he had. This is a prime minister who wants to, I think, centralize power, who wants, you know, to control the country much more tightly. Will he succeed? Now, going back to Pauline, the question which you raised, the future of Ethiopia after Tigray looks to me very messy. I don't think there is any strong appetite for Ethiopia to return to some kind of a centralized state. I think just about 6 months ago, people in the south voted to create a new state, Sidama. And that tells to you that on the ground, in the countryside, there is a strong appetite for autonomy, for self-governance, whether it's ethnic-based or coalition of ethnicities. So Ethiopia cannot be reconstructed as a centralized imperial state. Ethiopia can only be governed as a democratic federal system. And I think that is the genius of people like Meles, who, despite all their flaws, I think realize that the only way in which Ethiopia can be held together is to have that federal system. And I think unraveled that system. Thank you.
Maybe Rashid said that there is no country in the world which used that level of armament to put law and order in the country. But I say that there is no regional state in the world which attacked its own army, which has been protecting it from the Eritrean invasion and stayed there for 20 years. So that's what I wanted to say.
Okay, thank you very much. Of course, as we can see, this conversation really can take a long while. And this just brings to fore the complexity of the conflict in Ethiopia and where Ethiopia is at the moment. I think what is not lost from this discussion is, you know, the deep power analysis that is needed and to really understand how change then happens in Ethiopia and what that change means, not only in Ethiopia, but also in the region as well. I think another thing that has come out quite concretely is that conflict will really not solve anything. And I think right now, maybe moving forward, is looking at a political settlement and looking at how this might look like and what then that might mean for Ethiopia as a country. Of course, the issues of misinformation with the media blackout, whoever has caused the communication cut, I think the impact is still the same, that there's no information coming out and that a conflict can go on for so long with very little information coming out of it. I think one thing that Rashid also raised that is of importance is looking at the inward expansion of the conflict as much as we look at what the regional implication would be. I think internally, as Ethiopia is constituted, it is something that, you know, really needs to be looked at. And what Rita also raised about, you know, unity at all costs, and I think this is what was touched on with the last question, is that viable and can Ethiopia go back to a centralized form of government? I'd like to thank you all very much for spending your afternoon with us. I'd like to say thank you very, very much for our panelists for joining us today. Thank you for spending time with us. To the participants, thank you very much for being part of this conversation. And as usual, this is a neutral space where we encourage more discussions and different perspectives to what is going on within the region. So without further ado, I hope you have a good afternoon. If you were here physically, I'd say come and have a cup of tea. But alas, this is what COVID has brought to us. So, bye. Yes, have a cup of tea. Thank you very much.
Bye.
All right. Bye, Rashid. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.